friends. Tonight, as you've just heard, after a period of some 8 weeks, we come to the end of our current series of lectures, a series which has dealt week by week, in one way and another, with the subject of the higher evolution of the individual. And we end this series with a question. We end it with a very important question, not to say vitally important question, a question which arises, which cannot but arise, which inevitably arises sooner or later, whenever one genuinely tries to evolve, tries to develop, or even just tries to be oneself in any authentic manner. Especially does it arise if one attempts quite specifically with relative consciousness and awareness to follow what we usually call, what we usually refer to as the spiritual path. And this question arises with all the more force and is all the more relevant and all the more imperatively demands an answer when one tries to follow that spiritual path in one or another of its oriental forms. And that question is, of course, the question which stands as the title of the lecture this evening: is a guru necessary? Now, I'm quite sure that as soon as this question is asked, all sorts of pictures arise in people's minds, especially if they sit back and close their eyes. All sorts of beautiful, all sorts of wonderful pictures. Some people may see brilliant blue skies, may see beautiful white snow peaks, and a little further down, just above the snow line, they may see snug little caves. They may even see in their mind's eye pictures of well-built, square-looking, solid, picturesque, remote Tibetan monasteries situated in the midst of beautiful scenery in inaccessible valleys, little Shangri-Las and so on. And they may even, if they remain daydreaming and visualizing long enough, they may even see in their mind's eye benign, smiling pictures of wise old men with long white beards, with starry eyes. And they may even see, if they look and gaze a little longer, they may even see pictures of bands of devoted disciples sitting at the feet of the wise old men and gazing spellbound into their eyes. And perhaps they may even see pictures of these disciples, these lucky disciples so situated, sort of floating up into the air, floating up into nirvana with hardly any effort on their part at all. But this evening we're not going to indulge in pictures of this sort. We're going to banish all such pictures quite ruthlessly, and we're going to leave them aside, as it were, at least for some time. We're not going to let our imaginations run away with us as soon as we hear the magic word guru. We're going to consider the whole question of is a guru necessary in a comparatively sober and matter-of-fact fashion. We're going to try to understand what a guru really is. We're going to try and understand what a guru is not. And this should enable us to see, of our own accord, for ourselves, whether a guru is necessary or not, and if he is necessary, in what manner and to what extent. We shall also, towards the close of the lecture, be taking a look at some of the attitudes, Eastern and Western, which can be adopted with relation to the guru. Now we're going to start with the negative first, and we're going to proceed after that to the more positive. We're going to try to understand in the first place what a guru is not. We're going to consider this question under four main headings. We're going to try to understand, in fact to see, that a guru is, first of all, not the head of a religious group. That he's not a teacher. That he's not a father substitute. And not a problem solver. First of all, the guru is not the head of a religious group. Now, by a religious group, we do not, of course, mean a spiritual community. We spoke about the spiritual community and what that really is last week. By a religious group, we mean, or rather by a group of any sort, whether religious or non-religious, we mean a number of what I described last week as non-individuals organized into a power structure. This is what we call a group. We went into all this rather thoroughly last week, and we saw that groups, in this sense of the term, organizations of non-individuals into power structures, can be both religious in the more conventional, the more establishment sort of sense, and also non-religious. And the religious groups, in this sense of the term groups, are of several kinds. We've got sects, we've got churches, we've got even monasteries and groups of monasteries. And these all have their respective heads. And if one turns to them, if one thinks of them, one finds that these heads usually have very long and very resounding titles. I tried to look up, just as a matter of interest, the title of the Pope, but I discovered it was so long I couldn't include it in my lecture. And we usually find that heads of these religious groups not only have very long and resounding titles, but are also regarded with great veneration, with great devotion, by their followers. In other words, by other members of the group to which they belong and of which they are the head. But if one looks into it a little more closely, one finds that the other members of the group, the followers, are not devoted to the heads of the religious groups for what they are in themselves, what the heads of the groups are in themselves as persons, as individuals, but for what they represent, what they stand for, if you like, even what they symbolize. Now you might think that they stand for, or represent, or symbolize something spiritual, and in a sense they do. But that isn't what they really represent, or what they really stand for, or really symbolize. What the heads of the groups really represent is the group itself. They are the heads of the group. That is their principle, their main significance. So therefore, members of such groups usually feel that an attack, for instance, on the head of their group is an attack on the group itself. Any disrespect shown to the head of the group by people outside the group is interpreted, is felt by members of the group, followers of the head of the group, as disrespect shown to the group itself.